Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
Hey, it's Carol and Tim.
And we have something new and exciting for you.
Everything you love about Bloomberg Radio is now in your car.
The new Bloomberg Business app, now featuring Apple CarPlay and Android Auto.
Listen to your favorite Bloomberg radio stations anytime.
Plus, every Bloomberg podcast, the latest news and more, all at the click of a button.
It's free and simple to use. Just download the Bloomberg Business app on your smartphone and connect your phone to your car.
The Bloomberg Business app, now with Apple CarPlay and Android Auto features. Download it free in the Apple App Store or on Google Play.
Presented by our sponsor, Interactive Brokers.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Everything will always be all right when we go shopping. Well, you know that it's going to be all right when we go shopping.
All right, everybody, we want to stay with the shopping theme, if you will, and the retail sales theme. You know, more U.S. economic data. We said shoppers opening up their wallets a little bit less in October after quite a summer spending spree, and also as inflationary pressures are easing. So, I don't know, Tim, soft landing, anyone, maybe?
I mean, if you're in the camp that there's going to be a soft landing, you have plenty of things and plenty of data to point to over the last couple of weeks that certainly support your argument. Another inflation report this morning, too, Romain mentioned this PPI, Producer Price Index, joined yesterday's surprisingly soft core CPI reading to signal that momentum for disinflation in the month picked up. Carol, the print will boost Fed officials' confidence that overall inflation is moving toward their 2% target.
Getting there. Still not there, though. Target and also TJ Maxx out with results of mixed views in terms of how investors played it out. Let's get to it, and let's talk about the data as well as the earnings. Bloomberg News International Economics and Policy Correspondent Michael McKee here in studio, along with Jen Bartoshis. She's Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Retail Staples and Packaged Food Analyst. She's on Zoom from BI headquarters in Princeton, New Jersey. All right, Mike. So let's cut to the chase. We were saying, before we talked with our TV colleagues, I was listening to you this morning. We're like, we wish we were talking to Mike first, just to kind of get your take on retail sales a little bit more.
Well, retail sales were reasonably good. There was a slowdown, but you have to remember when you look at these numbers that they are calculated in dollar terms and the percentage changes in dollar terms. So as inflation goes down, the amount that is sold in dollar terms goes down.
So we pay less for stuff, right?
Right, which is why we constantly see a lot of variation in gasoline in this report, because gas prices go up and down, and so gas retail sales go up and down when you're talking about it in dollar terms. So inflation's come down a lot, and that has had an effect. We saw a very big September, surprising a lot of analysts, and that was revised higher. And because retail, so they don't do a great job of accurately counting retail sales in the report. It takes a couple months to get all the revisions in and get all the retailer reports in and do the math and that sort of thing. So the first report is generally off some. And so we saw this big revision to September, and we could see the same thing perhaps in October. But the key is that the revision of September was the end of the third quarter, so it sets us up at a higher level going into the fourth quarter, which is a good thing. And then the American people gave every impression that they're still willing to go out. Well, at least everybody except Carol is still willing to go out and go shop. And that was for her husband.
She's sticking to her story, okay?
It's true.
She's sticking to it. Cool. But if they're still willing to go out, then the question is, are they going to come out continually through November and a week from Friday and then all through Christmas?
How much of the perceived softness that we got in the data today is about gasoline, though, Mike?
It wasn't as much about gasoline as we thought, actually. Gasoline sales were down 3/10, and overall retail gasoline prices were down 10%, and according to the PPI, gasoline prices in the month were down 15%. So you would think there would be a bigger impact than there was. Now, these are seasonally adjusted numbers, so that may have had something to do with a reason. The biggest changes were in autos, a little worse than anticipated, because auto sales went down, and that's another hard one to translate, because auto sales are unit sales and retail sales are in dollar terms, and they add in service and parts and stuff like that. Well, that was a little worse, but also strong were the internet retailers. And so you're still seeing people shopping. Maybe they were just too busy getting kids back to school, all that sort of stuff, and they stayed home.
Well, let's see what's on the mind of consumers, because we actually got two that are actually, you know, brick and mortar, TJX and, of course, Target today. Jen Bartosius, you cover the retail space for us here and these names. Talk to us a little bit about what we got from the companies.
Yeah, sure. Thanks so much. I'll start with Target, where you know, I think everybody had sort of been waiting for it with bated breath for some positive news out of Target, and that's what they got today. And so as a result, you see the stock really just consistently up all day long. The idea behind that is you're seeing margin expansion, you're seeing inventory under control. These are all good signs as they head into the holiday season. Even though the top line is down and same-store sales were down, they weren't down as much as people feared they would be. So overall, it's a positive story coming out of them. And then with TJX, you know, obviously, there's been a lot of speculation about the flight to value, where consumers are looking for ways to stretch budgets or find things on, you know, at a deal. And so that's what we're seeing play through with these retailers today.
Do you think that TJX, some analysts are saying that TJX are, you know, it's down because of the conservative forecast that it gave for the holiday quarter. Do you think they're kind of on the lower end as well, Jen?
Yeah, I think they're a little bit on the lower end, and the, you know, I do
like
agree
they're being conservative.
Yeah, exactly, that they're being a little bit conservative. I think there's still some question as what's going on out in the market. And to kind of tail on to what you were talking about with retail sales, you know, one of the things, if you think about an area that was a little weaker, like restaurants, you know, you have to wonder whether consumers are pulling back in order to save up that money to be able to spend it for Black Friday and for Cyber Monday and to get a jump on their holiday spending. And so, I think that there are some indicators out there that we could have a pretty solid holiday season, but there are retailers like TJX that are being a little bit more conservative on their forecast.
Okay, so have not started holiday shopping yet or thinking about holiday shopping, but I'll add that to the list. Jen, one more on Target about inventory management. Did they, you know, this is a company that has talked a lot about shrinkage, a lot about theft. They've closed stores saying that as a result of theft. Any commentary about that type of inventory management today?
Yeah, actually, so there was a little bit of positive news there. What I'll say is that shrink continues to be a headwind for Target and for the greater retail industry. Again, the numbers came in better than Target had expected them to come in. So again, that means that some of the tactics they're taking, whether that's just closing down a few more of the self-checkout lines and using more actual cashiers, whether it's more video monitoring, some of these kinds of things that retailers use to cut down on shrink are having a positive impact. The other thing I would say is that it does not hurt that inflation is coming down and that people are slowly feeling that some of that pressure is being relieved. If you look at the cycles over time, you do tend to see shrink spike at times when people's budgets are under,
Makes sense.
under under strain.
So, Mike, I'm thinking we're about a month out. December 13th is the next Fed meeting. What I'm thinking about is, in terms of retail sales in general, will it not kind of fall apart as long as people are still working?
Yeah, that's the general assumption, and it's one reason that the there's not going to be a hard landing camp argued that you can't have a recession, a contraction in spending when people are still getting jobs at the rate they are, and they've got money to spend, because they're just going to spend money on their normal lives. They won't have to cut back. And so the general feeling now is we're going to see maybe a slowdown in this quarter. The Atlanta Fed GDP now is 2.1 as of today, but it's still going to be, I mean, that we used to think that was good.
Right.
And so it's still going to be a reasonably strong economy going into 2024, and it'll stay that way unless there's some sort of external event.
Next data point on your kind of radar right now.
Well, we kind of drop out of a lot of stuff and get into housing, and we know housing has a lot of problems at this point over the next couple of weeks. The thing that will really matter to the markets next is going to be the PCE, which is at the end of the month, and whether people's incomes are still rising and people's wages are still rising, and then whether they're spending or not. And we'll get the PCE inflation numbers, which a lot of that can be calculated once you have both CPI and PPI, and a lot of people who do that kind of work were out today saying we're going to see a nice decline in the PCE inflation indexes as well.
And preferred by the Fed, right?
And preferred by
that's
the
2% that matters.
Jen V, just save 30 seconds for you. What's the next report, retailer may be reporting, that's on your agenda, just quickly?
Walmart tomorrow morning. And, you know, I think that, you know, Walmart was up a little bit today. You know, again, looking at positive results out of Target, you would expect that you would see much of the same out of Walmart tomorrow.
All right, guys, thank you so much. Really perfect roundup in terms of retail and the U.S. consumer. Bloomberg News International Economics and Policy Correspondent Michael McKee, who I saw shaking his head no that I don't look at myself on YouTube. or yes. And then, of course, Jen Bartoshis, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Retail Staples and Packaged Food Analyst. Thanks so much, Jen.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
As you know, U.S. President Joe Biden and his Chinese counterpart, President Xi Jinping, they are meeting, and it has been a much anticipated sit down, the first time in a year where the two leaders of the two most important economies in the world are meeting. It comes amid a relationship that has been badly strained by economic competition and military and diplomatic missteps. So we wanted to really have a conversation that is not just about this week's meeting, but just about long-term, what really matters.
And we got a great roundtable. We got Dexter Tiff Roberts, Director of China Affairs at the Mansfield Center at the University of Montana, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council's Asia Security Initiative, and former Bloomberg Businessweek China Bureau Chief based in Beijing for more than two decades. He's also the author of The Myth of Chinese Capitalism, The Worker, The Factory, and The Future of the World. He's on the phone from Missoula, Montana.
Well, great to have both of you with us. I will say...
I didn't introduce Tom Orlick. Sorry.
Oh, you didn't.
No, sorry. Tom Orlick. We can't forget about you. Bloomberg Economics Chief Economist Tom Orlick. He's on Zoom in our Washington, D.C. Bureau. Forgive me, Tom.
And forgive me, just tracking kind of all of the news on this meeting this week. We have heard President Xi call the U.S.-China relationship the most important bilateral relationship in the world. President Biden noting that they don't always agree on things. So let's get to it. Tiff, let me start with you. I'm not sure how you best describe this relationship. Mutualistic? Do they both benefit? Does one benefit more than the other? You know, do they harm one another? Like, how do you think it? How do you describe this symbiotic relationship?
Well, I think it is a symbiotic relationship, and both sides absolutely need the other. That's obviously true on the economic and trade side. That's also true in managing all these global challenges, from climate change to global health, and the list goes on. So that both sides need each other, but I think it's become abundantly clear over the last at least 10 years that they also will continue to clash with each other. They have very different ideas about how the world should be organized and who should be in charge, and that's just going to continue going forward. You know, we have some We have some good news probably coming out of the meeting happening right now, likely to come out of that. But I think the longer term, very, very serious tensions between the two countries are there, and they're not going away.
Hey, Tom Orlick, come on in here and just describe, you know, answer the same question. How do you describe the relationship? Is it mutualistic? Is it symbiotic? You know, and you're looking at it through the economic lens, of course.
So first of all, let me say that I thought was hoping that you didn't introduce me because I need no introduction.
Oh, it's true.
I was a little bit disappointed when you circled back. Great to be here and great to be on the call with Tiff, my old friend and colleague from Beijing. Here in Washington, D.C., it's kind of pretty hard to find anyone who has a positive word to say about China. And I'm pretty certain if we went to Beijing and we listened in on some of the conversations there, they wouldn't be having warm feelings about the United States either. Right now, though, I think the incentives for both sides are aligned towards bringing a bit of stability to the relationship. The U.S. has got a war in Ukraine, war in the Middle East. They really don't need things blowing up with China at the same time. And Xi Jinping, well, he's wrestling with a monumental crisis in the real estate sector, which is hammering growth, hammering wealth for China's middle class. And there's growing concern in Beijing that the investment just isn't coming in anymore. So for both sides, the kind of the long-term strategic competition, the suspicion is still very much there. But right now, the incentive is to bring a bit of stability to the relationship.
Well, and let me follow up on that. And Tiff, let me bring you back in. I mean, if there weren't those domestic challenges, maybe for each, would this meeting be so important, or the importance of keeping this relationship going? Do you think that would still be there?
I think that, you know, it's very important. It's been a year since they've met face to face. A lot's happened since then. I think we need, you know, one concrete thing that'll probably come out of this, people are saying, analysts, people watching, is that there'll be a resumption of military-to-military exchanges. That is really, really important. President Joe Biden said in the introductory remarks today that there must be no misconceptions or miscommunication between the two sides. And I do think, as I mentioned earlier, the differences and the challenges between the two countries and the potential, unfortunately, for even a military conflict going forward, particularly related to Taiwan, are such that the two leaders have to be talking to each other. Mm-hmm. So I think it's critically important that they are meeting. Whether or not it's, as you know, whether or not we get all that we would like out of that meeting, I don't know if we're going to get our pandas back. We got to add that to the list. 50 years of pandas. We don't want to see them say goodbye to the U.S. forever. But I do think it's critical.
One thing I want to ask, and Tiff, since you both know each other well, Tiff, do you have a question for Tom? I mean, you both understand China in a way that many people do not. So I wonder if, Tiff, you have a question for Tom.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's wonderful being on with Tom. I'll say through the airwaves here, or the radio waves. Hello, Tom. We haven't seen each other in a while. We need to change that. But I guess one question I would have for Tom, one of the areas that I'm very concerned about is what I see as Xi Jinping's increasing, and it's become overpowering, politicization of the economy. That includes his obsession with, near obsession with security, defining the economy about whether or not it's secure. And then we see these crackdowns on foreign investors and American companies as well related to that. So I'm just interested, Tom, to what degree do you worry about that politicization of the economy? When does Beijing say things look really bad? You know what? We need to back away and maybe let the economy function a little bit more like a market economy again going forward.
Well, I think it's a really great question. I mean, my feeling is that the sort of narrative about the politicization of the Chinese economy, whilst not entirely without substance, has run a little bit too far. Let's sort of break it down into two pieces. So the first piece is Xi Jinping's crackdown on the big tech companies, Alibaba, Tencent, Meituan, China's versions of Amazon and Meta and Uber. One way of thinking about that is the Communist Party doesn't like entrepreneurs. Another way of thinking about it, which I think actually makes more sense, is that big tech monopolies had too much power. They were gouging suppliers. They were milking customers. And policymakers decided they were going to do something about it, right? So is that anti-entrepreneur, or is it good public policy, or maybe it's a bit of both? And then when China thinks about the United States and sort of worries about, you know, a more hostile relationship with the United States, well, I mean, let's not forget that President Trump imposed tariffs on billions of dollars of Chinese goods, and President Biden has blocked sales of crucial technologies, leading-edge semiconductors, to China. So yes, China's certainly more worried about security and thinking about the economy a bit more through a security lens, but that's not without reason.
Well, next time around, we promise we're going to let you, Tom, also ask Tiff a question because we've run out of time. But
Carol, if you make me ask Tiff a question, I'm going to ask for a piece of your annual bonus for doing a little bit of your work for you.
Forget it. It ain't going to happen. No,
wait,
just
we get
kidding.
Bonuses?
No. Tom, we're like, you're funny. Listen, both of you, so appreciate the knowledge that you have of China specifically, President Xi, and just make it such a richer conversation and bring a lot to certainly our audience. So thank you so much. Bloomberg Economics Chief Economist Tom Orlik on Zoom in our DC Bureau needs no introduction. Both of them. Tiff Roberts, Director of China Affairs at the Mansfield Center at the University of Montana, also the author of The Myth of Chinese Capitalism.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
All right, everybody, you are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week. We'll keep an eye on shares of Cisco in the aftermarket and continue to look for any kind of news on that conference call as the stock is down in the aftermarket, as we said. All right, so listen, one of the things that we talk about a lot is private credit and private lending. We say it all the time. Last couple of years, it's been a dominant theme at the Milken Global Institute Conference that happens every spring annually. Morgan Stanley says the private credit market at the start start of 2023 was worth about $1.4 trillion. It's estimated to reach about $2.3 trillion by 2027.
All right. Well, private credit is not a monolith. We talk about it like it's this one thing, but there are certainly different types of private credit. Our next guest has some concerns about parts of the market. Christina Padgett is head of leveraged finance research and analytics at Moody's, where she does credit research and chairs high yield rating committees. She joins us on Zoom from New York. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. Good to have you with us, Christina. Look, do we ever know really how the private credit market is doing? There's not quite a ton of transparency there.
There isn't a lot of transparency. So what we use in terms of determining some of our perspective is the fact that, at least in my case, I've followed leveraged loans and private equity for decades, and we think a lot of what we've learned from those markets apply to the part of private credit that is very concentrated in leveraged lending to private equity-backed businesses. So that, you know, in addition, we have in the U.S. BDCs, Business Development Corps. Those are direct lenders. They file publicly. They have ratings on their bonds. And we have frequent discussions with management teams, and they do report performance on a portfolio basis. Less insight than we have in your typical leveraged loan market, where we're looking at the individual loans. In this case, we're taking more of a portfolio view.
So does it make you feel confident about making calls about the market?
I think, you know, we don't see ourselves maybe as making calls, but as highlighting the current credit environment and thinking about risks that apply to that particular sector. And we have a certain amount of confidence evaluating those risks. And so when we think about the market today, there's been a lot of positive performance, particularly among the direct lenders. But that was before, you know, the dramatic change in the rate environment and the potential for the rate environment to change economic growth projections to sort of to moderate.
So, Christina, what you're saying, though, is you look at what, like the Blackstones, the KKRs, Apollo, right, to get an idea of what's going on more broadly. Is that fair?
I would say that there are direct lenders that are part of those organizations that are publicly rated, that file publicly, and that we can make a more detailed assessment of. But I think there's also some assumptions that can be made from the visibility we have there to the overall market. You know, there's also just the fact of, you know, sharing information with colleagues, sharing information at conferences, and understanding the macro environment is pretty key to understanding performance of the direct lenders themselves. They also compete with the syndicated loan market, and right, some of that competition gives us some sense of where, you know, risk may reside.
I guess because, you know, like Tim and I talk about this all the time, it doesn't feel like there's as much transparency. And I guess we're all trying to find out, you know, could this be a market that comes undone in some at some point? I mean, I understand certainly the big firms that we've talked to, you know, they have something at stake. They want the loans that go to, or the private lending and the funds that their investors tap into, they want them to go well, right? Because that's how they then build up new funds and continue to have investors come back over and over again. But we have seen the impact of a higher rate environment create some issues. So I'm just wondering, you know, if there was a private credit crisis, how would it play out?
So that's not necessarily the easiest thing to unpack, but I'll start by saying I agree with you. It's the lack of transparency that gives us pause as well. It is decidedly less visible kind of lending than what you see within the banking system. So, you know, from that perspective, we entirely agree. And I think the way that unwinds, one way that I think about it is that at least at the moment, it's been a relatively helpful valve in terms of liquidity. When companies couldn't access the syndicated loan market, there were direct lenders that they could find, you know, some ability to refinance, for example. So to the extent that that continues to function, it may be a positive element within the sort of financial ecosystem. The challenge is, to your point about transparency, is the level of risk-taking. And is there an excessive level of risk taking? And if you then see some underperformance among some of these direct lenders, then does their future ability to raise funds and support these businesses that have what one might argue is excessive leverage becomes more challenging? Because I think when you roll back the dynamic, you just see more businesses using more leverage, and that just makes them more vulnerable in any kind of deteriorating environment.
Where are you seeing distress appear in the market right now?
It depends on how broad-based an answer you want, because where I sit, I see corporate distress. And so those are highly leveraged businesses that built their balance sheets perhaps in 2021, when the market was offering, you know, sort of broad-based lending very cheaply, and multiples, acquisition multiples were high. So that market changed. And suddenly you have a lot of debt and your earnings projections are materially lower. Most of these businesses do happen to be owned by private equity. They're mostly LBOs. In the syndicated loan market, they're restructuring those loans mostly through distressed exchanges. Our expectation is on the direct lending side, those are more like bilateral negotiations in which the direct lender may be able to extract some additional equity in addition to getting maybe more flexible terms or more liquidity from the direct lender.
Hey, listen, just have time for one quick last question. At some point, as a result of private lending, do we not need smaller banks, community banks, and so on and so forth, because it feels like these guys are serving that purpose? And just got about 30, 40 seconds.
Not my area of expertise, but I think they provide different functions. I think the lending that goes on among direct lenders is very different than the lending goes on among community banks.
Well, listen, this is really cool. I hope you will come back, because we'd love to continue this conversation. We feel like it's such a big part of the financial world, and we're learning more and more each day. So thank you so much. Christina Padgett, Head of Leverage Finance Research and Analytics over at Moody's, where she does credit research and chairs high yield rating committees.
Hey, I want to get some breaking news that crossed moments ago. SpaceX getting U.S. approval to launch its Starship after its April mishap. This is ending an almost seven-month hiatus and inching Elon Musk closer to his goal of sending humans to the moon and beyond.
Yeah, the FAA reinstated the Starship launch license. The agency just putting that out. It just crossed the Bloomberg terminal. Not immediately clear when SpaceX would conduct a launch from its site in Texas, but Musk previously said the company was targeting as early as Friday. So, man, getting right back on the launch pad.
Yeah, Starship's also going to be used for launching the next gen of Starlink satellites.
This is why we need the White House wants.
Oh, yeah.
Right? More oversight of all the stuff that's going up in the air.
Yeah.
Just saying. Elon Musk's been busy lately. All right, everybody. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
We just mentioned Cisco and Palo Alto just out. Both are down in the aftermarket. Palo Alto Networks slipping after missing their billings estimates. So that stock, I'm just taking a look, down about 8.5% in the aftermarket. And then you've got Cisco plunging after cutting its year revenue forecast. And that one is really falling off a cliff as well. I'm just taking a quick update for you. Down about just about 9% here.
Well, let's get to our next guest. He's the co-founder and CEO of Ignite. It's a software company that focuses on data security, data governance, collaboration software. He knows a thing or two about Silicon Valley and those companies that you just mentioned, Carol. The startup has raised about $140 million from backers, including Goldman Sachs, Kleiner Perkins, Google Ventures, and it's got an annual run rate of more than $200 million, growing between 25 and 35%
with
per
us
year.
With us is Vineet Jain. He is co-founder and CEO of Ignite, and he joins us on this Wednesday. Vineet, it is so good to have you here with us. We want to talk about your business and kind of get your thoughts on some different things. But, you know, we're just coming off of Cisco out, stock dropping after their, you know, cutting their full year revenue forecast. So corporate spending, you know, on IT, we're seeing it fall off. What are you guys seeing in terms of the business environment?
You know, that's an interesting question. Thank you for the opportunity to have me on the show. You know, while you're hearing a lot about how the spending climate is very tough, extra deal scrutiny, every dollar of spend, especially on subscription services, leave aside hardware, is being questioned. While all that is true, we're kind of seeing a dichotomy. There's a class of companies which are eking out respectable growth, present company included, versus those which are not making the earnings or whatever the expected earnings were. So I think it is coming down to execution and the focus in terms of refining your go-to-market, product-market mix. And therefore, the performance is kind of mixed. Some companies are doing very well. A lot of companies are struggling.
How are you guys doing?
While we are still in Q4, it's the hardest quarter of the year. But based on everything I can see, I think we'll be fine.
Well, you know, it's such an important part of kind of figuring out the economy. And we're at this interesting point that we kind of read every little data point that comes across. So, Vineet, from your perspective and vantage point, how would you describe the economy?
So when I look at our target market, because my answer is going to be in the context of the market we're going after, both right. in terms of geographies and certain industries. So we are predominantly North America. 88% of our revenue comes from North America, 12% from Europe. And within the US, there are three industries we are focused on specifically. One is AEC, which is an acronym for architecture, engineering, construction. The second one is biotech, life sciences. Third one is financial services. AEC in particular is booming. Construction companies, architecture, engineering firms that we speak with, they're saying they have a book of business which is filled out till end of next year. But even there, you're seeing companies focused in Florida, companies focused in Texas, they're doing very well. Companies focused in New York, or let's say in my neck of the woods, San Francisco, not so much. Biotech life sciences is taken a breath in terms of lack of follow-up funding, funding being hard to come by. But financial services, on the other hand, is rocketing. So it's kind of a mixed bag. So from my perspective, if something ebbs, something else flows. And we just have to figure out how to make our numbers to be in that 25-30% growth range, which has been core to our operations for the last 8 years.
The geographical differences, is it just because that's where certain markets are located in terms of your three different businesses, or what's doing well versus not? Or is it because more expensive parts of the country to kind of live and operate for businesses, and that's problematic? I'm just curious about those. I thought it was interesting you said Texas doing well.
Or is it sector-based?
New York not. Yeah, and that's what I'm trying to get to. Is it, or is it sector-based?
You know, it's predominantly sector-based. But then when you look at biotech life sciences, it's concentrated in three areas, right? It's San Diego, South San Francisco, and Boston.
Yeah.
So even though it's very industry-specific, but from that lens, it'll feel like in Boston in particular, as well as San Diego, we see a slowdown. But honestly, as you said, it kind of boils down to very specific industries. And within that, the size of the company. Like when you look at construction engineering, the big GCs, general contractors, mid-size, small-size, subcons, electrical, mechanical, they're all doing very well. But in life sciences, the early stage, the emerging biotech, they're struggling. Whereas the big guys, especially the ones if they are in the obesity drug business, like you've been hearing about Novo Nordisk, Eli Lilly, business is booming.
Hey, I want to talk more about your business, because you guys are have talked publicly about going public at some point in the next year. Just give us an update on what the thinking is there, and if you have a date targeted at this point.
I was warned that this question is going to be asked. So in full transparency, we have all the underpinnings of a good, solid public company. Not in terms of just going public, but sustaining growth with the beat and raise model for several quarters to come. So from that perspective, in full transparency, we're keeping our options open in respect to this potential future financial event. But at the same time, when you look at the state of the IPO market, despite all the noise around the three, you know, Klaviyo, Arm, Instacart, the market truly hasn't opened in the world of tech. So we are waiting and watching to see what happens, but meanwhile, not taking the eye off the ball in terms of keep growing, keep muscling up, and keep doing it fiscally responsibly.
No pressure from some very well-known investors, Goldman Sachs, Kleiner Perkins, Google Ventures, kind of a who's who in the VC world. No pressure from them in terms of going public? They're comfortable waiting it out?
You know, that's an interesting question, more so in the context of we are 16 years old.
Mm-hmm. And they've been waiting it out.
They have been waiting it out. And in fact, you'll be amazed to see I have Floodgate, which is the early seed stage investor, Series A, and rarely do they do Series B. They've all been with me for a long time. So the good news is they're seeing the value of their investment increase consistently, constantly. We've never been a high flyer. We never grew 90, 70% with insanely high losses, very high losses. It's predictable growth. As you introduce my company, you know, it's been between 25, 35%. But in the last 7 or 8 quarters, we have been EBITDA positive with improving EBITDA margins. And that kind of metrics is back in fashion, if I were to say. So as they say in sales, revenue hides all sins. Everyone's waiting and watching and seeing the value increase. So the pressure is therefore abated by that factor. But eventually, honestly, you know, I do have to have a liquidity event at some point.
Hey, before we let you go, I just want to take a big step back here because I spent a lot of time on your website in preparation for this interview. And maybe it's because I'm not an IT professional, but talk to me about what exactly you guys do in the context of where consumers, where businesses interact with the services that you sell.
Because you work with Steve Madden, BuzzFeed, like what exactly do you do for these guys? And we just have about 50 seconds.
So very simply stated, our world is all about unstructured content. The world is awash in content being created of all kinds. This is not just Word, PowerPoint, Excel, but PDFs, videos, pictures, you name it. And it kind of is a very interesting point of view that we have that at the end of it, the end user, the knowledge worker that you refer to, wants to get their job done. They want data closest to the edge with whichever device they're on to do their job. So what we call is value maximization. But with growing spate of data, especially going into the cloud, whether our cloud, other clouds, there's a constant inexorable push from the IT perspective to risk mitigate, to risk manage, control all those risk profiles that develop as your data is getting more spread. So that aspect of it, which is risk mitigation while value maximization, and combine that into one platform, which is what Ignite is. So unstructured content, value maximization, risk mitigation, bundled into one platform, specifically focused on the mid-market.
All right. Well, we've run out of time, but we do hope you'll come back because we'd love to kind of continue the conversation and broaden out even more with you. Vineet, thank you so much. Vineet Jain, he's co-founder and CEO of Ignite, joining us, as you know, on Zoom from Mountain View, California.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, we want to switch gears to a story that's in the upcoming new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek. It's about the smuggling networks that ferry migrants over the U.S.-Mexico border. They've long relied on vulnerable Americans to do the driving, figuring that they are the people most inclined to risk criminal charges for quick cash. After all, drivers can be paid thousands of dollars per passenger.
Yeah, in fact, in such cities as Tucson and Corpus Christi, Texas, recruiters trawl homeless shelters, welfare offices, and secondhand cell phone shops for prospective drivers. But real-world recruitment is time-consuming and tedious. And now those recruiters have turned to a more efficient tool, Carol, social media.
They have indeed. Julia Love is a technology reporter at Bloomberg News in the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week on newsstands tomorrow. She writes about the cartel-backed networks that are using Snapchat, TikTok, and some other apps to entice drivers into transporting migrants. She joins us from our San Francisco bureau. Joe Weber is the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. He joins us here in our interactive broker studio. As we mentioned, it's in the upcoming new issue on newsstands tomorrow, but also online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and already on the Bloomberg terminal. Bit of a sobering story, a real story.
Very much so. It's actually kind of a sequel to a story that Julia wrote earlier in the year, which was just a magnificent feature about an American coyote. And we kept in touch because we really wanted to see what else she could find. And lo and behold, this one connects directly to her beat, and it shows that, you know, the tech companies that are the platforms that so many of us use to talk with one another are also a way that cartel-backed groups are recruiting coyotes. So take us to the border and how this plays out, Julia.
Sure. Well, thanks so much for having me today. Essentially, human smuggling networks need a lot of drivers to transport migrants after they cross into the United States on the last leg of the journey, and they have long recruited vulnerable U.S. citizens to do this work. In the past, they would recruit people in person at bars. They would also go to homeless shelters, you know, places where they knew they could find people who were in a tough spot. But now social media is enabling them to do that with much greater efficiency.
How do they find, Julia, these people on social media? You highlight a few of them in your story. It's, again, incredible reporting. I really encourage everybody to go read it. But how do these orchestrators actually find these people on social media?
Like, tell us about Michael.
Sure. Yeah. So it's a mix of different techniques. Sometimes they will post ads that appear briefly that users respond to. The post might say something like, "Want to make quick cash? Message me. Drivers needed." Other times they will reach out to people proactively. There's certain types of users who they seem to target. Young men are a desirable demographic. They see them as a little bit more impulsive and willing to take a risk. And so our main character for this story is a young man who was recruited on Snapchat. He had been struggling to pay his bills, and when he got this offer to make, you know, a few thousand dollars, he found it enticing.
Did he do it? Tell us about the process, like how he found out about, you know, kind of what it was all about, or what he thought it was about, and then maybe what it really was about.
Yeah, so he gets a message on Snapchat, you know, asking if he wants to make some easy money, and then you know, he expresses interest, and the conversation is then shifted to WhatsApp, where it becomes clear that he will be transporting migrants, and he has some reservations, but he ultimately decides to do it, you know, under some pressure from the recruiter. And yeah, he sets out on a trip, and he's arrested on his very first drive, which is often how these trips end.
Which is, you know, such a sober way for this to go. But I'm curious, because he even thought about maybe not doing it as he was considering it, right? And he was some of his friends were approached too, right? And so what drew him to ultimately do this?
So what defense lawyers have really underscored to me is that, you know, these smuggling networks are ultimately, they operate with the permission of the cartels, they're criminal groups, and so, you can't really back out of this work. You know, they often exert pressure. You know, there's a huge power imbalance between these young people and the folks who are recruiting them. And so that's what happened to our main character. He did have second thoughts, but the recruiter, you know, sent him his address and just indicated, you know, you're going to go through with this.
I mean, how do they find, like... It's kind of scary stuff here because, one, you're dealing with a cartel or a cartel-backed group, I should say, Julia. Two, they already know this identifying information about someone. So in that case, he certainly felt pressured to move forward with it. You're a technology reporter, too. So, and this is a story as much about technology and the way that that's certainly changed many, many lives. What do the tech companies say about the way these platforms are being used?
So the tech companies stress that this issue is a priority to them, that they do not allow human smuggling on their platforms, that they're working closely with law enforcement and doing everything they can. But workers tell me that behind the scenes, you know, these trust and safety teams are tasked with so many big issues, elections, child safety, and so it's tough for them to find the resources for a problem like this. And it can be a tough thing to get to the bottom of. You know, the posts use veiled language. It can be a little bit tricky at stale to determine, you know, well, are they trying to recruit a coyote or are they recruiting a private chauffeur? And so, it's tough.
Well, and you know what I thought was interesting is, and you include this in your story, Julia, is that you make a point of, like, the stuff we post on social media can actually make you a target for recruiters. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Oversharing.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, so one story that we feature in the piece is a young woman in the Phoenix area who, she was a single mom going through a very tough time, and she's approached by an acquaintance on Facebook who asks if she wants to make some extra money. And so I think that's just an example of how, you know, young people can kind of unwittingly make themselves smarts.
And what about the companies in all of this, Julie? Because obviously a company like Snap or Meta, like, I mean, and you could almost use any messaging platform to, you know, post, you know, and lure people in into this kind of underworld. What are the companies capable of doing? What do we know about what they have done, and how are they limited?
Yeah, so the companies can certainly moderate content. They filter by emoji and keywords. So one emoji that's often used in these cases is an emoji of a little chicken, which stands for pollitos, slain for migrants used along the border. So there are some tools they can use, and yet the posts really seem to be proliferating. Law enforcement's frustrated. They do feel like there's more that the companies could be doing. And lawmakers have begun to pay attention to this issue. Kyrsten Sinema, a senator in Arizona, has proposed a bill that would make it easier for companies to report these posts to law enforcement. And so I think there really is pressure on the companies to curb the activity.
All right. And while Kim Kardashian probably doesn't have to be worried, there are some influencers that are out there on social media that have been targeted as well and recruited. Talk to us about this.
Yes, so there, it does seem that that the networks are interested in having their message boosted by people who already do have a large following online. And so there's one case we note in the story where there was a young rapper in southern Arizona who had a big following on social media, and he was ultimately hired to be a recruiter and to post and coordinate these jobs on social media. And his defense lawyer maintains that he was targeted like anyone else, that they appealed to his vanity, and he's now in prison.
Yeah, 36 months sentenced in federal prison.
So what's it like when you go down to, you know, Arizona, and I mean, you did spend some time in the courthouse there. Like, how many of these cases are coming through, and what kind of luck is law enforcement having in actually cracking down?
Yes, so I spent about a week in southern Arizona. It was really striking to be in the courthouse. It felt like, you know, at least half of the judges' calendars were filled up with these cases, defendants being indicted and sentenced. And I also went for a ride-along with a local sheriff's deputy who was trying to catch human smuggling drivers in the act. He didn't have any luck during my ride-along with him, but he was kind of longingly looking at his phone on Snapchat where he could see the posts in action, and the challenge was just actually finding those drivers.
Hey, can you talk, Julia, a little more about how you reported this story? I mean, don't give away all your secrets here, but how you reported it and how this got on your radar post the American Coyote story that you wrote earlier this year.
Sure. Yeah. Well, so I was previously a foreign correspondent in Mexico, and one of the big revelations of my time at the border was just realizing that the operations of these human smuggling networks extend really deep into the United States. And so I just became really fascinated by that shadow economy. And I have spent a lot of time looking through court cases, and those became kind of the seeds of my reporting.
Julia, one thing I wonder, is it working though? Are a lot of individuals ultimately getting smuggled in, a lot of immigrants, or, and you get into this in the story too, that law enforcement, there's some really easy red flags when they know someone is doing it, like out of state licenses. But I'm just curious if it is though ultimately successful in bringing
people in. Or
if
they even know.
Right? Or if they even know, right.
Yeah, it's a tough problem. I think law enforcement feels like they only apprehend a tiny fraction of the cars that are transporting migrants, and yet for these young drivers who, you know, don't really know their way, you know, there is a good chance they'll get caught, especially if they go out on multiple drives, and if you're offered, you know, the chance to make a few thousand dollars, well, you, not only will you be enticed to do it once, but you might very well decide to try your hand at it again.
What are the economics here, Julia, when it starts with the person who's paying to be smuggled across the border? These people certainly save money for a very long period of time. Who are they paying? How much do, and to what extent do the cartels sort of take that? I'm kind of wondering like how it ends up being a couple thousand dollars per person when it gets to that actual driver.
Yeah, so prices for the journey to the United States have really skyrocketed. It all depends on where migrants who you know, are departing from, those who are coming from outside of the Americas pay a lot more. But the money is kind of, you know, partitioned out along the way. Typically, there is a fee that goes directly to the cartels in order to cross the border. And then the drivers ultimately will be paid a certain rate. Oftentimes it's per passenger. And I've seen that really run the gamut. I think it depends a lot on the driver's bargaining ability. And lawyers tell me that especially with these young drivers, they often aren't paid the wage that they're promised when they do complete the job. And I think the attitude is essentially, you know, well, what are you going to do about it?
So I, you know,
it's rough.
We've been talking about the border forever. And I just think that it's so interesting that there's this little wrinkle in it, which is, you know, how does technology fit into this? Well, the same apps that you use for everything else are the ones that are being used to basically bait people into making a couple bucks. And, you know, also that side of this of like less about the migrants, more about Americans being drawn into this is also super interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And right, taking the risk, right, to make some money.
And it's this whole new generation of coyotes.
Yeah. It's funny that you say that about the apps. I was thinking about WhatsApp, right? Because a lot of times the conversation switches to that, and I think about, okay, so what's their responsibility?
It's encrypted.
In all of the, I understand, right, but it's just, it's interesting. Julia, thank you so much taking us to a place that many of us will never see or understand, but you certainly have shed a lot of light on it. Julia Love, of course, technology reporter at Bloomberg News in our San Francisco Bureau. Our thanks to Jill Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. great story.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you, thank you. The story, the new issue, it's on newsstands tomorrow. It's already online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. And of course, always on the Bloomberg terminal. This is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just got about 10 minutes or so. About 18 minutes.
Hey, there's some math in there somewhere. She can do it. I know it's the first time you've done Drive to the Close, Carol.
It's like yesterday when you're trying to figure out a third of the votes.
Hey, that's because the font was too small on C-SPAN, okay?
I couldn't read it.
Close to the TV and I couldn't even see it.
It's like being around my brothers. Oh, my God. It's so harsh.
Don't include me in this.
It's so harsh. All right.
Who's kind?
Yeah. Amit Deshpande.
Yeah.
Let's get to it. He is founder and chief investment officer at the Global Value Focus Centerstone Investors. Back with us. He's on Zoom in New York City. Abe, save me. How are you?
Great. I'm going to stay away from all kinds of math. Just give it to you how it is. We're going to be good.
Give it to us straight. Thank you for being here. The rally yesterday, was it significant in your view in any way?
Well, I mean, anytime the other 493 stocks decide to get out of bed, I find some significance
in
it. And, you know, it's been obviously a very difficult kind of period to, if you're a stock investor investing, you know, on fundamentals, the market's been mostly driven by like the obsession with interest rates and inflation and all that. But you're starting to see some very positive indications that just because of how much lead time people have had to prepare for the quote unquote recession, like 2 years people have been waiting for this, right? And because of that, like a lot of companies have been cautious. They've been, you know, emphasizing efficiencies in their organizations. And you've seen this latest quarter, like earnings are actually, you know, I mean, even Target today, like earnings are exceeding expectations. And that's partly because the revenue, you know, demand never really collapsed, but then they became efficient. Now the earnings improvements are kind of shining through. So it's, in a way, it's interesting. Couple of weeks, really, the stocks are of course, they've adjusted or they've responded to the inflation numbers and whatnot, but they're also responding to positive fundamentals. And that's good news for the other 493 stocks.
So do you think we're at a turning point, or we hit a turning point with the most recent batch of data?
it's hard to like pinpoint like a day or most recent batch of data. Like, I think the trend line is good though, right? So you have, you know, basically it's been touch and go for the economy. Like it's been, you know, it's in the post-operating room, it's kind of recovering, but it's got all these needles stuck into her body. And every time there's a blip in the heart rate monitor, people freak out. But the fact is the patient is recovering. And I think increasingly that's going to dominate the news flow rather than the last, you know, year has been all about inflation and interest rates.
Let me ask you about the rally specifically yesterday in small caps, closing above its 30-day moving average, approaching both its 90-day and 200-day moving averages. Small caps as a whole, I think, are up about 2 to 3% on the year. Small caps are important, right? Because it tells us a lot about expectations for our domestic economy. Was yesterday a technically significant move that could create a new floor in small caps?
So yesterday, it had a few things going for it, right? Banks were a good, healthy bull market requires participation by, you know, most mm-hmm. stocks.
Right.
But importantly,
kind of everybody banks. In the pool kind of deal.
Yeah, everybody in the pool and small caps. You know, and small caps are generally in the U.S. are reflective of the, you know, more reflective of actually the U.S. economy as a whole. And so the fact that they're rallying, the banks had a decent day. I mean, I have still some concerns. Don't get me wrong, but for the moment, at least, there was like, you know, a bit of a sigh of relief. And I think, again, this just sort of goes along with the narrative that I had earlier in the year that we'd do one last shock from the COVID earthquake. And we're going through that right now. Huh. But then, you know, we'd emerge to the other side in whatever normal economy we're going to have, we're going to emerge through it. And that seems to be kind of taking place. We seem to be on that trend line.
So what are you concerned about?
Well, I mean, in this era, as you know, every sort of like 6 months, something else comes out of the woodwork, right? So who knows what it is. I think it's a good idea to, you know, have a margin of safety in whatever you're investing in, the securities. We're value investors. So we're right now finding, like very adequate margins of safety in lots of companies all around the world, despite whatever's around the corner, you know, if anything, for that matter. And, you know, and that leaves kind of plenty of upside if things, you know, turn out a little bit better than expected.
Right, right. No, it's a really good point because I feel like the negativity tone is certainly out there. So if we surprise to the upside, we can see markets off and running, especially certainly the equity side. Hey, two names that you brought that you're interested in, Air Liquide. I'm not good with French, but it is a French company. About a $95.3 billion market cap. ADRs trade here in the United States, up about 30% year to date. What is it about this one that you like?
Well, it's one of my favorite businesses around the world.
Yeah.
They have a business that takes air and separates it into its elements and sells it to industry. And it's typically a pass-through business, meaning whatever cost increases they get for energy, it's very energy intensive process. They pass that through the customer base. The customer base typically is a required sort of input to their process. Whether it's oil fracking or soft drinks or the medical business, semiconductor business is huge right now in Texas, Arizona. And so they're it's a huge global business, but they're very much geared towards any manufacturing resurgence that we have in the United States, which we've definitely seen a lot of evidence of that in the Southwest. In addition, the business is such that even in the worst environments that we've had economically, like think of 2008, 2009, right?
Right.
Their revenues went down like 5%. That's how stable it is. Huh. Right? It took a massive, like near depressionary environment to bring down revenues 5%. So it's very stable. And then the accounting is extremely conservative. They depreciate assets on a 20 year life basis, but the assets last for like 40 plus years. So there's a lot of kind of, for people like me, like to go through and adjust the earnings and look at the accounting and all that stuff. It's a kind of a fun business to look at. And like I said, steady, right? And dividend yield grows, call it 5% a year. And you're never gonna, this is not like a 10 bagger, like, you know, like a tech stock or anything like that. But as far as reliable, consistent, dividend paying, shareholder friendly, good balance sheet, you know, ticks all of those boxes.
All right, we're going to leave it on that note. Good to check in with you. If we don't talk to you before the end of the year, have a great holiday season. The ticker on that one, by the way, AIQUY. That was Abhay Deshpande.
It's already that time where we're saying, you know, have a great rest of the year.
I know.
6 weeks away.
See ya, 2023.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code Radio20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.